Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The phrase, behind every great man is a great woman, is relatively new, but it certainly applies to the days of our country's founding. It's the men who get the credit for it, but the role of their women and the women of the time has been largely understated. A few years ago, journalist and NPR commentator Cokie Roberts introduced us to many of these women and their accomplishments in her books Founding Mothers and Ladies of Liberty, The Women Who Shaped Our Nation, both for adult readers. Now she's seeking a younger audience. Her latest book is the illustrated Founding Mothers, Remembering the Ladies. It's most appropriate to discuss during this Women's History Month and just 2 days after International Women's Day. Cokie Roberts joins us by phone to talk about this latest book and some other things, I think. Cokie, it's so nice to talk to you again.
Lovely to talk to you, Don, and I hear things are actually nice in St. Louis today.
Well,
after this dreadful winter we've all been living through.
Yes, well, we have 70 degrees today, but snow flurries are predicted for tomorrow, so go figure. There's not much we can do about that except through it. Cokie, what was the motive and inspiration for writing for young readers this time?
Well, the publisher actually asked me to do it after Founding Mothers came out 10 years ago. And I thought it was a great idea because one of my goals in writing these books at all was to get to kids. And the grown-up books really are appropriate for, I would say, from middle school up. But I was thrilled when they asked me to write a kid's book. And then it turns out, Don, this was something I just didn't know anything about. The lives of good children's book illustrators are very, very busy. So finding someone like Diane Good, who did these wonderful illustrations, to find some time to do a book takes years.
It changes the whole complexion of the book, doesn't it, having illustrations such as those in this one?
It really does. I mean, she did so much research on her own about the women's clothes and all of that. Her husband found for her antique bits for quill, you know, the quill pens. And so she went through the experience of what it was like to actually write with an old quill pen in using ink, and she saw how it splashed on the page and all of that. And she got fascinated with the women's handwriting as well as everything else. And so at the very last minute, she said to me, "Do you think that we could find all of their signatures?" Huh. And so I, with some effort, contacted the various libraries and universities where the men's papers are kept. And we did track down all 10. There are 10 women featured in the children's book, all 10 of their signatures. And she copied them so perfectly, I told her she should be a counterfeiter in her next life.
You know, the effort of finding the signatures is nothing new because in having talked to you about your last books, finding the material, the source material, is in itself just a real struggle, isn't it?
It's detective work, absolutely. The fact is that people just didn't value women's letters from this period of time, and with the exception, the notable and wonderful exception of Abigail Adams. Her family, including the people, you know, contemporaneous people that she was writing to, understood the great value of her letters, and so they were always preserved, even though she'd write regularly and say, "Destroy these letters," but thankfully no one did. And the Massachusetts Historical Society has done a wonderful job of preserving them and putting them online and all of that. So that's the exception. The rule is that women either destroyed their own documents, like Martha Washington did, or the men destroyed them, like Thomas Jefferson did his correspondence with his wife. I actually heard just the other day, I didn't know this story till just now, that Bess Truman destroyed all of her correspondence with Harry Truman, and that he found her doing this, and he said, "Bess, what are you doing? Think of history." And she said, "I am. That's why I'm doing this."
Well, with that kind of sense of humor, now I really wish that she had saved
exactly.
those letters.
Exactly. And so it's very hard to come by this. Now, the farther into history you get, the easier it gets. But these 18th century, early 19th century writings are quite difficult.
But it's going to become more difficult for the next generation of historians because we don't do letters much anymore. It's all email now and electronic.
Well, you know, but at least email is written down, and you can print it out and save it. I mean, there was a period in there in the late 70s, early 80s, when it was all telephone communication. Mm-hmm. So at least this is written down, and I do urge people to save the emails. You find that they do tell a story over a period of time.
It's so easy, though, to hit that delete button, as so many people do.
Well, because as any district attorney can tell you, they're never really deleted.
Yeah. Well, we should point out, by the way, you just mentioned Abigail Adams a moment ago, that she is sort of referenced in the title of this book, Founding Mothers, Remembering the Ladies. That's a direct link to Abigail Adams.
That's right. So when one of the things that was so interesting about her was she was so ardent for independence that it drove her completely nuts that the men in Philadelphia meeting at the Continental Congress were just taking forever to declare independence. And she kept saying, "When are you going to declare independence? What's wrong with you people?" And finally, when it appeared that it was going to happen, she realized that there would have to be a new code of laws for a new country. And that's when she wrote the famous words to John, her husband, saying, "When you write that new code of laws, remember the ladies, because all men would be tyrants if they could." John, for once, really ignored her and laughed at her, which was not his habit. He took her quite seriously and depended on her most of the time. But when she said something that radical, he couldn't deal with it, and he shot back with the classic put down of, "Oh, you women really have all the power."
When do you think the men in politics did begin to remember the ladies?
Well, they didn't ever really. what happened was a lot of very brave women putting themselves on the line to insist that they be included. You know, people don't give up power easily, and that's what it required. But it is interesting that even contemporaneously, in the 18th century, there were some letters of men saying, "You know, knowing what we know now, we should have been more mindful of the position of women in the country."
Let me leap forward before we continue discussing the ladies of the time of our revolution and just after, and personalize it with your own family. Of course, your father was a congressman, and your mother, I gather, was fairly influential in that household, your household.
She was indeed, and as were the other women of her era. I mean, that's really how I started writing these books, is that I spent my childhood growing up in the Washington of the 1940s and 50s, seeing the incredible influence of the political women of that era, people like my mother, Lindy Boggs, and Betty Ford, and Lady Bird Johnson, and, you know, they were running everything. They ran the political conventions, they ran voter registration drives, they ran their husbands' campaigns, they ran the social service agencies in Washington, along with the African-American women who were there. Of course, they ran as kids. But I saw the tremendous influence that they had and figured that the women of this very, very important period in our history, when our very nationhood was conceived, had to have been at least as influential, and that's one of the reasons I started trying to find out about them.
Well, in this book, you focus on 10 women. Give us just a general idea, then we'll get a little more specific as time moves along. A general idea of the kinds of things that they were doing during this period that was so influential.
Well, some of them were doing things like writing propaganda. So Mercy Otis Warren is one of the 10 women, and she wrote poems and plays that were published in the newspapers and pamphlets at the time, and they were very influential in galvanizing public opinion against the British. You know, obviously there was no internet or television at the time, and so that was the means of propaganda. And then you had women like Esther DeBert Reed, who organized a very important fundraising drive for the troops at the depths of the Revolutionary War, when the troops were threatening desertion by regiment. And she organized a fundraising drive that raised, in 1780, in the space of a very few weeks, $300,000. And the newspaper articles at the time are very clear on what a difference it made in terms of troop morale. And along those lines, Martha Washington was incredibly influential. She, every winter of the 8 long years of the Revolutionary War, went to camp with the troops. And she did it because General Washington required her to, basically. He felt strongly that she and the other officers' wives were absolutely essential to troop morale, because they would come and they would sew for the soldiers and they would cook for the soldiers and pray with them and nurse them and put on great entertainments for them. And that was at a time when, you know, there were a lot of periods in here where our troops were not getting paid and not getting housed or clothed, and so they were restive, to put it mildly. And so having the officers' wives there to keep them occupied and feeling appreciated made a huge difference.
Is there anything inherently contradictory about this? I mean, if women had a second-class status at the time, yet they managed to maintain the kind of influence that you've been talking about here.
Well, I mean, Abigail Adams was aware of that. She said at one point to John, you know, we women are really better patriots than you men. The patriotism in the female breast is the least self-interested of virtues. And she said, because here we are suffering all of the hardships, making all the sacrifices for the cause, and if we win, you men will be held in high acclaim and will hold office, and we won't even be able to vote. So we're better patriots than you are. And that time he did have sense enough to agree with her.
I wonder what role Abigail Adams would be playing in today's society. I mean, not necessarily as a first lady, but just as a woman in today's America.
I think she would probably be very involved in politics. It was a subject that she cared a lot about, and she read up on in other countries' types of government and all of that. And I think she would be very much an activist. She was an abolitionist very early. She hated slavery. She felt at one point when we lost a battle during the Revolution that we were being punished for the sin of slavery. She felt strongly that one of the things that was great about America was that there was not big divisions among the classes, that she thought that, you know, there were people not terribly rich and not terribly poor. Now, she wasn't completely right about that, but that was her perception of it. And so I think she would be active on a variety of fronts.
You know, it's interesting, the number of women's rights advocates there were in those days, again, given that diminished role that women had, there were plenty of voices being heard clamoring for equal rights for women.
Yeah, I mean, I think legal rights was what they were mainly after, because keep in mind, Don, you know, married women couldn't own property. They were the property of their husbands. So they had so few rights that I think they wanted to start with legal rights before they even got to political rights.
One of the stories that I had forgotten it until I read your most recent book here, was the life of Deborah Franklin. And the fact, you know, I had no idea, I guess, that they lived apart for 17 years while he was overseas and she was running the postal service here
running
in this country.
The postal service and their businesses, you know. He had essentially they had printing shops that were kind of like Kinko's that went, were franchises that went out to the frontier, which was Pittsburgh. And he was gone. She ran them all. And he was grateful. He would say, oh, she's terrific. She's a great businesswoman. I couldn't do it without her. But he wouldn't come home, and she was desperate for him to come home. He was gone for so long, and he was in England at the time, lobbying for the colony of Pennsylvania, and having a wonderful time. And she at one point had to defend their house because his neighbors felt that he had not been sufficiently ardent against the Stamp Act, and they were furious with him and ready to come burn down the house. And she was advised to leave, and she said, I'm not doing that. Instead, she got a gun, and she got some cousins and with guns, and they protected the house. And he wrote to her from England and said, well done, Deborah. You know, carry on. But he refused to come home, and their only daughter got married, and she begged him to come home, and he just wrote saying, keep the wedding cheap. And finally, she died. And he wrote to a friend that he had to go home because my wife, in whose hands I left the care of my affairs, has died. And so he had to go back and, you know, get everything settled. Now, while he was home, he did, you know, help write the Declaration of Independence. I'll give him that. But then off to France he went, where he helped form the alliance that won the war. But he was not a nice guy to his wife and daughter.
You're listening to Cokie Roberts, the author of Founding Mothers, Remembering the Ladies. It's a book for youngsters aged 7 or 8 to 12 years old. I'm Don Marsh, and this is St. Louis on the Air. We'll leave Ben Franklin for the moment and talk about some of these women who are doing things. You digress from the 10 subjects of your book, Cokie, to talk about women who were warriors and they were spies and they were couriers and all the rest of it. Another remarkable story about a woman who served for 3 years alongside the men, and they never knew that she was a woman.
Right. Deborah Sampson. She became quite famous, and she disguised herself as a man, and Robert Shirtleaf was the name she took. And she fought, and she was wounded, but she kept fighting and volunteering for more and more dangerous assignments. And finally, she got sick and went to the camp hospital. And of course, there the doctor discovered she was a woman, and discharged her. But as a result of her service, she did receive later a congressional pension for her heroism. And that, Don, by the way, is another way that we do learn the history. And that's a very important fact, is that when there are government documents, we can learn a great deal. And pension records are one of the ways that we do. That we do find out about people. So another woman who had a full pension was Margaret Corbin, whose husband was shot at the Battle of Fort Washington in New York, and she took over his gun, and she was hit 3 times, but she kept firing until the British finally won the war, the battle, and she, too, was awarded a pension, and she's buried at West Point. So, you know, there were women who were recognized, at least to some degree, for the valor that they performed.
You mentioned Martha Washington a little while ago, and there's another name that every school child in this country knows and has known. But again, you mentioned the visits to Valley Forge and the visits with the troops. Most people don't know how active she was.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting because one of the great things I've been doing since this book came out is going around and talking to school groups, which has been so much fun. I've really loved it, but including at my grandchildren's schools. But the kids, when I say to them, you know, have you ever heard of Martha Washington? Yes. Who was she? And they'll say, well, she was George Washington's wife. Well, that's true. And some will say she was the first lady, which is, of course, also true. And that, of course, was a very difficult role because She had to be formal enough and stately enough so that the courts of Europe would take the new United States seriously. But she had to be informal enough and down home enough to appeal to people who had just fought a revolution against the monarchy. So it was a tough role, and lots of people had their opinions about it and what she could do and, more important, what she couldn't do. And she wrote at one point to her niece, she said, you know, people say I'm the grandest lady in the land, but I think I'm more the chief state prisoner. And I think a lot of first ladies have felt that way ever since.
No doubt. We're talking with Cokie Roberts, the author of Founding Mothers, Remembering the Ladies. Cokie, we have to take a break. We'll do that now and come back. I'd like to get our listening audience into this conversation at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can also send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org, or we'll take a tweet at STL on air. Back with Cokie Roberts in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with Cokie Roberts, author of Founding Mothers, Remembering the Ladies. You know Cokie Roberts, of course, because of her fine journalistic background and the commentaries that you hear frequently on NPR. Cokie, one of the women that you deal with in the book is Phyllis Wheatley, and I wanted to talk about her for a moment because I think very much largely unknown to history. She was a slave, and she was black, and she's part of your group.
She was, and she was a slave in Boston, Massachusetts, and that is something that I think a lot of people don't realize, is that the horrors of slavery were legal in all of the colonies before the war, and she came in the 1860s when she was probably 7 or 8 years old, and they know that because she had baby teeth still, and she went to live with a family called the Wheatleys, as she was supposed to be helping out in the house. And it was very soon apparent that she was a very smart little girl. And the teenagers in the household started teaching her to read and write and the Bible and English. And then she was so clear she was so smart, she started studying a lot of other things, Greek and Latin, all of that. And by the time she was a teenager, she started publishing poems in the newspapers, and nobody could believe it. Nobody believed that these poems were written by this teenage slave girl. And so all of the prominent men of Boston wrote letters endorsing her, saying, yes, in fact, these poems were written by this girl. And they sent off the poems and the letters to London, where the book of her poems was published, and she became an instant celebrity. One of the things that always amazes me is how fast news traveled across the ocean, considering how difficult it was. But she was a celebrity in both Europe and America, and when George Washington, in fact, started fighting the British, the first place they were camped was Cambridge, Massachusetts. British were in Boston, and he asked to see her because he wanted to meet one so gifted by the muse. And she did write poems, most of her poems were religious in nature, but she did write some that railed against slavery and were influential.
And I'll bet you 99.9% of the school kids in the country today have never heard of her.
Actually, I think she's better known than some. When I ask the kids, they seem to know more about her than most people. So the schools seem to be doing a pretty good job on Phyllis Wheatley, but they've certainly never heard of Mercy Otis Warren, for instance.
Right. I want to take a call from Karen in St. Louis here because I think it segues nicely into our conversation about Phyllis. Karen, go ahead. You're on the air with Cokie Roberts.
Thank you. I was going to ask if you included the role of indentured women and slave women in your book in terms of supporting the founding mothers. Doubtful that the president's wives and the officers' wives were working by themselves and unsupported. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you so much.
you're quite right. And one of the things I point out in the book is that when Martha Washington came into camp every winter, she came with foodstuffs that had been preserved and cloth that had been woven over the summer at Mount Vernon. And I describe it as one of the many contributions of African Americans to the revolutionary cause, because, of course, the people who were doing that work at Mount Vernon were slaves. But the book is about the influential women who influenced the founding fathers. So, of course, they are elite women, but they definitely were supported, no question about it.
Karen, thanks so much for your call. Let's bring in Sheila, calling from University City. Go ahead, Sheila. You're on the air.
Hi. First, it's an honor to talk to you, Koki. I've followed your reporting, and I think you're terrific.
Aren't you kind? Thank you.
I wanted to mention, since you especially talked about John Adams and Abigail, the wonderful historical musical 1776,
yes,
about the struggles within the Second Continental Congress for declaring independence from England. We kind of take that for granted as a done deal, but it certainly wasn't. And the writers of this musical did a great deal of historical research, and there are, you know, a few examples of dramatic license. But one of the things that's very poignant about this musical,
a huge example of dramatic license in the presence of Martha Jefferson there.
Right, right. But there's a lot of correspondence between John and Abigail based
right.
on their letters that was used very theatrically in, I think, a very effective way. And I just think that, you know, knowing that there is going to be some dramatic license in it, it's a nice introduction for children.
I agree completely. I took my grandchildren to it, and they loved it. And actually, they had seen the movie
right.
planned, but I took the theatrical production was at, of all places, Ford's Theater, so that was terrific, and we all really, really did enjoy it. Of course, they had me grumbling on the side saying, well, wait a minute, that letter actually came many years before that.
Right, right.
I did want to mention that
the movie is readily available, and there's
I'm sorry, what?
Additional information about the historical events of the time. But the thing that surprised me about it was just knowing how difficult it was to get all of the members of the, all the representatives of Congress to actually agree on this, accepting the Declaration of Independence. Like I said, I just was raised to think, oh, this was a done deal, no big deal, but it was.
No, it was a very big deal. Well, you can imagine. I mean, it's basically saying we're no longer going to be the people we thought we were. And many of them felt very strongly that they were loyal citizens of Great Britain. And so that was a huge fight. And, of course, it remained a fight in the colonies. The loyalists felt strongly that they wanted to remain attached to Britain, and many of them left. And, in fact, when the British were defeated in Boston at Charlestown, the British sailed away with many, many loyalist families accompanying them and going to Canada.
Anyway, thank you again for all your reporting in these two wonderful books.
Thank you. Thanks for calling. And I highly recommend 1776. It's great fun.
And she made some reference to Congress agreeing on something. That is not something we've heard much about recently, but we can talk more about that a little bit later, Koki Roberts. I want to bring in Barbara calling from St. Louis before we have to take our next break. Barbara, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to congratulate Koki on this wonderful book. My book group read it, and we had great discussions about it.
Good.
And I've also enjoyed hearing you and your husband at the Jewish Book Festival here in St. Louis.
Uh-huh.
On previous occasions, and you just mentioned one of my most favorite plays, 1776, and despite the poetic license to give Jefferson his wife with him, the slavery issue is really pronounced in there, and the dilemma that it posed for the delegates, and having just, you know, seen 12 Years a Slave win the Academy Award, I think it's very timely to remind people what a great decision, you know, how difficult decision that was. But again,
And same thing was true, of course, with the writing of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm actually working right now on a book around the Civil War, and of course, it broke the country apart. It was a moral issue of such magnitude, huge. I mean,
it was really an unsolvable problem. I mean,
and a horrible one. I mean,
right.
12 years a slave really brings it home to you. But the country finally did have to go to war to get past it, and thank God we did.
Well, thank you again for all your work, and we enjoy hearing you here in St. Louis.
That's very kind of you. Thanks so much.
Barbara, thanks for the call. Before I take that break, Koki, she mentioned your husband, Steve, whom we hear from time to time on NPR, filling in for Diane Rehm and such. But I miss Rebecca. Where is she? What's she doing?
Well, I think she misses doing radio, too. But she decided to go back to graduate school. She was, you know, she was frustrated because nothing was really sort of coming through for her at NPR. And so she went back to graduate school in, of all things, forensic anthropology. Huh. And she is now a forensic anthropologist, using her knowledge as a producer of great programs at the Smithsonian.
Good for her. I miss her a lot. I miss her infectious laugh. There was something about her laugh on the air that I just loved. Anyway, well, so much for
woman,
Rebecca.
Woman,
good
woman.
Yeah, good luck to her and her new career. I have to take that break. We'll come back and continue our conversation with Koki Roberts in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back to our conversation with Koki Roberts, the author of Founding Mothers, Remembering the Ladies. We'll continue that conversation in just a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. In Jefferson City, a House committee is holding a hearing about an alternative Medicaid expansion proposal backed by two Republican lawmakers. The proposal will likely make it to the House calendar, but Marshall Griffin reports it might not make it to the floor debate unless Senator Rob Schaff of St. Joseph calls off a Senate filibuster. Schaff has said he will filibuster any bill that considers expanding Medicaid. And the Missouri Court of Appeals will hear oral arguments tomorrow in a lawsuit over changes to pensions for St. Louis City firefighters. The mayor's office says the changes made about 2 years ago were crucial to the city's financial health, as its contribution had reached more than $31 million annually. But firefighters claim the city did not have the authority to make the changes. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to Koki Roberts. Koki, I'd like to talk a little about current events, if you don't mind. There's so much going on, and I know you're on top of all of this. I'm curious as to your take on how badly you think President Obama may be getting beaten up in this whole Crimea thing.
Well, the problem that he has with that is that it follows on his statement about drawing a red line in Syria and then seeming to back away from it. And so there's a sense that he doesn't follow through, and both his enemies and some of his friends saying, you know, he's a weak president. Now, I'm not exactly sure what he could be doing, but there is a sense among people in the foreign policy community that he is giving Putin an opening and that Putin is walking through it, and that came mainly because of the situation in Syria.
Also giving the Republicans an opening.
Yes, and they've got a few others at the moment, so they're feeling pretty good, you know, despite the fact that we have polls. ABC had a poll out last week showing that 68% of the public thinks the Republican Party is out of touch with people like you, or people like me is the way it's worded. But still, they were tying in what we call the generic vote, which is, if you were voting today for the Congress, would you vote for a Democrat or a Republican? Now, you know, that's one of those questions that doesn't mean a whole lot because it's district by district. But on the other hand, we have learned that that number does serve as something of a predictor. And it is tied, which for Republicans is very good because in off years, they tend to have a better percentage of the vote than Democrats do. And finally, in that same poll, in the 34 states where there are senators up for election or reelection, the Republicans were leading by 12 points. So they're looking at 2014 and feeling pretty good about it. They're, you know, they're hoping they don't have some of the same wacko candidates that they have had in the last couple of elections that have blown their chances of taking the Senate. So far they've done a good job of keeping those kinds of candidates out of the process, and they think they're going to keep the House and retake the Senate, and that will make Barack Obama's last 2 years very difficult indeed.
I'm sure you paid a lot of attention to the events at the CPAC conference over this past weekend, a number of speeches, and all of the principal players were there. What did you make of it in general, and in particular out of Senator Paul's showing in that poll at the end of it?
Well, he won it last time, too, and he, you know, a lot of people there are basically libertarians, and both he and his father were heroes of the libertarian cause, and so I think that's not all that surprising. CPAC is a problem for Republicans, though, because what happens there is everybody vying with everybody else to show just how conservative they are. And then what they say there comes back to haunt them when it gets to a general election and a mainstream audience. So they have to be careful, And that is the fundamental problem for the Republicans on the national level, which is that what they have to do to get the support of the base of the party and the people who are going to get organized and give money and do get out the vote drives and all of that, the things you do to get that group of people behind you often turn off independents and people in the middle of the road.
Senator Cruz turned off a few people in recent days with his comments about Bob Dole.
Honestly, Bob Dole, John McCain, and Mitt Romney, you know, and he said they're all decent men but not men of principle. And John McCain, you know, who was held as a prisoner of war for 7 years in Vietnam, and Bob Dole, who lost his arm fighting for this country in World War II. I mean, it's just remarkable to have somebody say something like that.
I wonder if he has any kind of a chance to walk away with that nomination.
Cruz?
Yeah.
Sure he does. I mean, one of the things that's interesting is that usually the Republican nominee is pretty well anointed before you even get to the primaries. You know, it's the person who's next in line or the person that the party leadership, you know, thinks should be the nominee. This time around, there's no such person. So that's going to make it very interesting for all of us. And, you know, it's anybody's guess who gets it. Now, I think that when Cruz says something like he did at CPAC, it just raises the hackles on a lot of people. And I don't think he has a good governor on his tongue, and that's always a problem for a candidate.
Well, let's look at the other side of the coin. The polls of recent days just show what would be an insurmountable lead, it would appear, for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, but this is, you know, they showed that in 2006, too. Not as much as now, but they did show that. And a whole lot of that is name recognition and the fact that that women are eager to have a woman president, but what happens in the actual election becomes something else altogether. I don't think that she has made up her mind to run because she knows how rough it's going to be. I think that in some ways it's all sort of taking off without her, that there's organizations springing up and committees getting formed and money getting raised, and at some point it becomes inevitable, I suppose. But I don't think she's at that point yet.
But what if she didn't? What if she doesn't?
Well, if she doesn't, Joe Biden certainly does. But again, I don't find he's not somebody who would be head and shoulders above the others. I mean, he's been vice president, yes, and he's a very, very, very likable person. But he will be old, and he has, he's tried it before and had his problems. There are some younger Democrats who are sort of waiting in the wings. Mark O'Malley, the governor of Maryland, Kirsten Gillibrand, the other senator who took Hillary Clinton's place in the Senate from New York. I mean, there are people around, and I think they're just biding their time, waiting to see what she does.
You know, there's a lot of talk here in Missouri about our governor, Jay Nixon, emerging on the national scene. He's term limited out and can't run again. Do you ever hear any buzz about Jay Nixon amongst your conversations in Washington?
No, but you're hearing very little buzz about anybody. And he does have the kind of profile that on paper makes for a very good candidate. First of all, we do tend to elect governors. The last time around, there were two senators running against each other. I mean, when it was Obama and McCain. So we elected a senator, but we normally don't. The fact that he's from the Midwest, from a state that still is a swing state, and that he's been elected there, all of that works for him, I think. So his is the kind of profile that does that people look at and say, well, that makes sense. Now, whether that works as a candidate is something else altogether, and you would know that better than I. Mm-hmm.
You know, you mentioned Senator Gillibrand. Interesting, what's the word? I want to use the right word with regard to her association with our Senator Claire McCaskill over the sexual assault bill and conversation that's being held in Washington. This is one of the first really civil exchanges that I've heard. When it was all over, the two of them were extraordinarily kind to each other, even though it was a tough fight.
It was a tough fight, and it was a very emotional fight, mm-hmm. and still they were kind to each other,
yeah.
Because they basically felt that something had to be done, and that the question that they disagreed over was what, but not that. The question of sexual assaults in the military are an outrage. The fact, though, is, Don, and I'm happy to say this, is that the last little tiny bit of bipartisanship in Congress is among the women of the Senate. Now, Gillibrand and McCaskill are the same party, but you heard actually in that debate the Republican women also up and being very highly complimentary of both of them and voting more with Gillibrand. But the fact is that they have regular dinners together. I tease them all the time that they just want to be in a testosterone-free zone. And they say there's some truth to that, but it's also true that they get a great deal done. And when we were in that ridiculous situation at the end of last year with the government shutdown, it was the women of the Senate in both parties who basically said, oh, for heaven's sake, this is absurd, and came together and put together the package that got us out of it.
You know, Senator Clinton, Hillary Clinton, over the weekend expressed some concern over saying that advancing rights and opportunities for women today seems to have stalled somewhat. Do you see it that way?
Well, of course, she was talking on International Women's Day,
right.
and I think was making an international statement, particularly given her experience as Secretary of State. She did set up a whole department in the State Department of Women's Affairs, essentially. It is true that if you look around the world, you see enormous problems. Where you look at some place like Afghanistan, where the American presence has tried very hard to improve the role of women, and it's a constant battle. And so I think that that you take that look around the world, and you do become fearful.
You're listening to Cokie Roberts. She's the author of a new book, Founding Mothers, Remembering Ladies. I'm Don Marsh, and this is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. I'd like to go to the phones now. We have David calling us from St. Louis. Cokie, we have time, I think, to take his call, so let's do so. David, go ahead.
Well, hi. Yeah, I appreciate you taking the call. You know, I was interested in, how can we get out of this intransigence that's going on in D.C.? And as a journalist, I'm wondering if are journalists being tricked into not believing in science anymore? I'm just wondering why some of these major scandals are based upon bad science anyway, like the FCC, centralization of the FCC ruling the other day about open access, the Keystone Pipeline. If farmers knew what that meant to loss of water, they'd be horrified. And so bad science is driving a story nowadays, and it's allowing, the government policy to be run badly because bad science is leading in the propaganda.
Well, you could get an argument going among scientists, quite healthy argument going among scientists about Keystone. I would put that one aside. But clearly, on questions like global climate change and all of that, you are seeing the great, great, huge preponderance of evidence on one side, and the political reality not being there, and that does become a question of where you say, wait a minute, there are facts somewhere along the line here, and so that does become something that goes facts and truth to the degree that you can find truth sometimes go away when you're in the middle of a heated political debate, and we've been in the middle of a heated political debate for years now.
Cokie Roberts, we have about a minute left, and let's come back to the book just to let folks know that it's more than just 10 stories about 10 different women. You have other features in the book that youngsters would appreciate.
Right, there's a timeline to begin with, and then there's interludes on women writers and women warriors. The children love the stories of the spies, but it's also a wonderfully, wonderfully illustrated book where you can really get a sense of these women with some whimsy attached. And I think I know because now I've been with enough kids who have read it. Kids really do love it. And by the way, it makes me a little bit crazy, Don, when someone says to me, well, I don't have any girls in the family.
I understand that.
Girls have been reading about men for many, many, many hundred years. It's okay for the boys to read about women.
a number of websites cited in the book, too, where they can go for even more information. Cokie Roberts,
right.
Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure talking to you again.
Well, wonderful to talk to you, Don.
Good Thanks. Luck with the book, Founding Mothers, Remembering the Ladies. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll take a look at new guidelines to help communities control tobacco use and addiction. Then we'll talk about efforts to enhance the Cahokia Mounds on the historic landscape. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thanks for listening. I'm Don Marsh.